Chapter 9. Hold It. In 1968, Dr. Arthur Kling left his office at the University of Illinois and caught a flight to Cayo Santiago, a wild and unpopulated island on Puerto Rico's southern coast. He grabbed some traps, captured a group of wild monkeys, then took the animals back to the lab to conduct a bizarre and cruel experiment. Kling began by opening the monkeys' skulls and removed a dollop of brain from each side. He let the monkeys recover, then released them back into the jungle. Beyond a few scars on their heads, the monkeys looked normal, but something was wrong inside their brains. They had trouble navigating the world. Some starved to death. Others drowned. A few were quickly devoured by animals. Within 2 weeks, all of Kling's monkeys were dead. A couple years later, Kling traveled to Zambia, just upstream from Victoria Falls, and repeated the experiment. Within 7 hours of releasing the altered monkeys back into the wild, all had disappeared. The monkeys all died because they couldn't recognize which animals were prey and which were predators. They didn't sense the danger of wading in a rushing river, swinging from a thin branch, or approaching a rival troop. The animals had no sense of fear because Kling had removed fear from their brains. Specifically, Kling had clipped out the monkeys' amygdalae, two almond-sized nodes at the center of their temporal lobes. The amygdalae help monkeys, humans, and other high-order vertebrates remember, make decisions, and process emotions. These nodes are also believed to be the alarm circuit of fear, signaling threats and initiating a reaction to fight or run away. Without the amygdalae, Kling wrote, all the monkeys, quote, appeared retarded in their ability to foresee and avoid dangerous confrontations. Without fear, survival was impossible, or at minimum, extremely precarious. Back in the United States, a girl whom psychologists would name SM was born around the same time with a rare genetic condition called Urbach-Wythe disease. The condition caused cell mutations in a buildup of fatty material throughout SM's body. It gave her skin a lumpy and puffy appearance, making her voice very hoarse. By the time she was 10, the deposits had spread into SM's brain. For reasons nobody understands, the disease left most regions unharmed but destroyed her amygdalae. SM could see, feel, hear, think, and taste just like anyone else. She had a normal IQ, memory, and perception. But as SM entered her late teenage years, her sense of fear diminished. She would approach total strangers, stand a few inches from their faces, and describe her most intimate sexual secrets, never afraid of embarrassment or rejection. She'd walk outside in a violent thunderstorm to chat with a neighbor, never worrying she'd be battered by debris. She'd eat food if it was around, but wouldn't bother stocking up if the cupboards were bare. SM had no fear of growing hungry. She even lost the ability to recognize fear in the faces of those around her. SM could easily register happiness, confusion, or sadness of her friends and family, but didn't have a clue when someone was scared or threatened. Worries, stress, and anxiety all dissolved along with her amygdalae. One day when SM was in her 40s, a man in a pickup truck pulled up and asked her to go on a date. She got in, and the man drove her to an abandoned barn, threw her on the ground, and tore off her clothes. Suddenly, a dog ran into the barn, and the man became nervous that people might be close behind. He zipped up his pants and dusted himself off. SM casually got up and followed the man back to his car. She asked to be driven home. Dr. Justin Feinstein met SM in 2006 while getting a PhD in clinical neuropsychology at the University of Iowa. Feinstein specialized in anxieties, specifically in how to get over them. He knew that fear was the core of all anxieties. Fear of gaining weight led to anorexia. Fear of crowds led to agoraphobia. Fear of losing control led to panic attacks. Anxieties were an oversensitivity to perceived fear, be it spiders, the opposite sex, confined spaces, or whatever. On a neuronal level, anxieties and phobias were caused by overreactive amygdalae. Researchers had spent 2 decades studying SM, trying to understand her condition, and trying to scare her. They showed her films of humans eating excrement, took her to theme park haunted houses, and even put slithering snakes on her arms. But nothing worked. Determined, Feinstein dug deeper and found a study in which human subjects were administered a single breath of carbon dioxide. Even with a small amount, patients reported feelings of suffocation, as if they'd been forced to hold their breath for several minutes. Their oxygen levels hadn't changed. The subjects knew they were in no danger, but many still suffered debilitating panic attacks. This wasn't a reaction to a perceived fear or an external threat. It wasn't psychological. The gas was physically triggering some other mechanism in their brains and bodies. Feinstein and a group of neurosurgeons and psychologists set up an experiment at the University of Iowa Hospital. They brought SM in and sat her down at a desk, then fitted an inhaler mask over her face connected to a bag that contained a few lungfuls of 35% carbon dioxide and the rest room air. They explained that the CO2 would not damage her body. Her tissues and brain would have plenty of oxygen. She would never be in danger. Hearing this, SM looked the way she always looked, bored. "We weren't expecting anything to happen," Feinstein told me. "Nobody was." A few moments later, Feinstein released the carbon dioxide into the mouthpiece. SM inhaled. Right away, her droopy eyes grew wider. Her shoulder muscles tensed. Her breathing became labored. She grabbed at the desk. "Help me!" she yelled through the mouthpiece. SM lifted an arm and waved it like she was drowning. "I can't!" she screamed. "I can't breathe!" A researcher yanked the mask off, but it didn't help. SM jerked and gasped. A minute or so later, she dropped her arms and returned to breathing slowly and calmly. A single puff of carbon dioxide did to SM what no snakes, horror movies, or thunderstorms could. For the first time in 30 years, she'd felt fear, a full-fledged panic attack. Her amygdalae hadn't grown back. Her brain was the same as it had always been. But some dormant switch had suddenly been flipped. SM refused to inhale carbon dioxide again. Years later, the mere idea of it stressed her out. So Feinstein and his researchers confirmed the results with 2 German twins who also suffered from Urbach-Wythe disease. The twins had lost their amygdalae, and neither had felt fear in a decade. A single inhalation of CO2 quickly changed that. Both suffered from the same debilitating panic, anxiety, and crushing fear as SM. The textbooks were wrong. The amygdalae were not the only alarm circuit of fear. There was another deeper circuit in our bodies that was generating perhaps a more powerful sense of danger than anything the amygdalae could muster alone. It was not only shared by SM, the German twins, and a few dozen others with Urbach-Wythe disease, but by everyone and almost every living thing, all people, animals, even insects and bacteria. It was the fear and the crushing anxiety that comes from the feeling of not being able to take another breath. Inhale a sip of air through the nose or mouth. For this exercise, it doesn't really matter. Now hold it. In a few moments, you'll feel a slight hunger for more. As this hunger mounts, the mind will race, the lungs will ache. You'll become nervous, paranoid, and irritable. You'll start to panic. All senses will zero in on that miserable, suffocating feeling. Your sole desire will be to get another breath. The nagging need to breathe is activated from a cluster of neurons called the central chemoreceptors, located at the base of the brainstem. When we're breathing too slowly and carbon dioxide levels rise, the central chemoreceptors monitor these changes and send alarm signals to the brain, telling our lungs to breathe faster and more deeply. When we're breathing too quickly, These chemoreceptors direct the body to breathe more slowly to increase those carbon dioxide levels. This is how our body determines how fast and often to breathe, not by the amount of oxygen, but by the level of carbon dioxide. Chemoreception is one of the most fundamental functions in life. When the first aerobic life forms evolved 2.5 billion years ago, they had to sense carbon dioxide to avoid it. The chemoreception that developed passed up through bacteria, then to animals, and on. It's what stimulates the suffocating feeling you just felt holding your own breath. As humans evolved, our chemoreception became more plastic, meaning it could flex and shift with changing environments. It's this ability to adapt to so many different levels of CO2 and oxygen that help humans colonize altitudes 800 feet below and 16,000 feet above sea level. Today, chemoreceptor flexibility is part of what distinguishes good athletes from great ones. It's why some elite climbers can summit Everest without supplemental oxygen, and why some freedivers can hold their breath underwater for 10 minutes. All these people have trained their chemoreceptors to withstand extreme fluctuations in CO2 without panic. Physical limits are only half of it. Our mental health relies on chemoreceptor flexibility as well. SM and the German twins didn't suffer from debilitating panic attacks because of mental illness. They suffered because of a broken line of communication between their chemoreceptors and the rest of their brains. This may sound very basic. Of course we're conditioned to panic when we're denied a breath or think we're about to be. But the scientific reason for that panic, that it can be generated by chemoreceptors and breathing instead of by psychological threats processed by the amygdalae, this is profound. All this suggests that for the past 100 years, psychologists may have been treating chronic fears and all the anxieties that come with it the wrong way. Fears weren't just a mental problem, and they couldn't be treated by simply getting patients to think differently. Fears and anxiety had a physical manifestation as well. 18% of Americans suffer from some form of anxiety or panic, with those numbers rising every year. Perhaps the best step in treating them was by first conditioning the central chemoreceptors in the rest of the brain to become more flexible to CO2 levels, by teaching anxious people the art of holding their breath. As far back as the 1st century BC, inhabitants of what is now India described a system of conscious apnea, which they claimed restored health and ensured long life. The Bhagavad Gita, a Hindu spiritual text written around 2,000 years ago, translated the breathing practice of pranayama to mean, quote, trance induced by stopping all breathing. A few centuries after that, Chinese scholars wrote several volumes detailing the art of breath holding. One text offered this advice: lie down every day, pacify your mind, cut off thoughts, and block the breath. Close your fists, inhale through your nose, and exhale through your mouth. Do not let the breathing be audible. Let it be most subtle and fine. When the breath is full, block it. The blocking of the breath will make the soles of your feet perspire. Count 100 times 1 and 2. After blocking the breath to the extreme, exhale it subtly. Inhale a little more and block the breath again. If you feel hot, exhale with ho. If you feel cold, blow the breath out and exhale it with the sound chui. If you can breathe like this and count to 1,000 when blocking, then you will need neither grains nor medicine. Today, breath holding is associated almost entirely with disease. Don't hold your breath, the old adage goes. Denying our bodies a consistent flow of oxygen, we've been told, is bad. And for the most part, this is sound advice. Sleep apnea, a form of chronic unconscious breath holding, is terribly damaging, as most of us know by now. Breath holding during waking hours is injurious as well, and more widespread. Up to 80% of office workers, according to one estimate, suffer from something called continuous partial attention. We'll scan our email, write something down, check Twitter, and do it all over again, never really focusing on any specific task. In this state of perpetual distraction, breathing becomes shallow and erratic. Sometimes we won't breathe at all for a half minute or longer. The problem is serious enough that over the past few decades, the National Institutes of Health has enlisted several researchers, including Dr. David Anderson and Dr. Margaret Chesney, to study its effects. Chesney told me that the habit, also known as email apnea, can contribute to the same maladies as sleep apnea. How could modern science and ancient practices be so at odds? Again, it comes down to will. The breath holding that occurs in sleep and constant partial attention is unconscious. It's something that happens to our bodies, something that's out of our control. The breath holding practiced by the ancients and revivalists is conscious. These are practices we will ourselves to do. And when we do them properly, I'd heard they can work wonders. It's a muggy Wednesday morning, and I'm sitting on a rumpled sofa in Justin Feinstein's office at the Laureate Institute for Brain Research in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Across from me is a window that looks out over a cardboard-colored sky and a paisley landscape of red and orange leaves. Feinstein is seated below it, flipping through a stack of scientific papers on a double-wide desk that has not one inch of vacant space. He's wearing an untucked, button-down shirt with the cuffs rolled up, flip-flops, and baggy khakis with crayon stains from his daughter. He looks the way you'd imagine a neuropsychologist to look, brainy with a touch of funk. Feinstein has been awarded a 5-year NIH grant to test the use of inhaled carbon dioxide on patients with panic and anxiety disorders. After his experience administering the gas to SM and the German twins, he'd become convinced CO2 could not only cause panic and anxiety, but it might also help cure it. He believed that breathing heavy doses of carbon dioxide might elicit the same physical and psychological benefits as the 1,000-year-old breath-holding techniques. But this therapy didn't require patients to actually hold their breath or block their throats and count to 100. His patients were far too anxious and impatient to do any of that. Carbon dioxide did it all for them. They'd come in, think about whatever they wanted to think about, take a few inhales of the gas, flex their chemoreceptors back to normal, and be on their way. It was the ancient art of breath holding for people too anxious to hold their breath. Breath-holding hacks, or as Feinstein would call them, carbon dioxide therapies, have been around for thousands of years. The ancient Romans prescribed soaking in carbon dioxide-rich thermal baths as a cure from anything from gout to war wounds. Centuries later, Belle Epoque French gathered at Royat in the French Alps to wade in bubbling springs for days at a time. The study of the chemical composition of the 4 mineral springs at Royat will show that we have several powerful agents at our command and that much is available for the treatment of many morbid conditions which resist the usual pharmaceutical applications we make use of in daily practice, wrote George Henry Brandt, a British doctor who visited Royat in the late 1870s, wrote. Brandt was talking about skin disorders like eczema and psoriasis, along with respiratory maladies like asthma and bronchitis, all of which were, quote, cured almost with certainty after a few sessions. Royat physicians would eventually bottle up CO2 and administer it as an inhalant. The therapy was so effective that it made it stateside in the early 1900s. Yale physiologist Yandel Henderson promoted a mixture of 5% carbon dioxide and the rest oxygen to treat things like strokes, pneumonia, even asphyxia in newborn babies. Fire departments in New York, Chicago, and other major cities installed CO2 tanks on their trucks. The gas was credited with saving many lives. all the while richer blends of 30% carbon dioxide and 70% oxygen became a go-to treatment for anxiety, epilepsy, and even schizophrenia. With a few huffs of the stuff, patients who'd spent months or years in a catatonic state would suddenly come to. They'd open their eyes, look around, and begin calmly talking with doctors and patients. "It was a wonderful feeling. It was marvelous. I felt very light and didn't know where I was," one patient reported. "I knew something had happened to me. I wasn't sure what it was." The patients would stay in this coherent, lucid state for about 30 minutes until the carbon dioxide wore off. Then, without warning, they'd stop mid-sentence and freeze, staring into space and striking statue-like poses. Some of them collapsed. The patients were all sick again, and they'd stay that way until the next hit of carbon dioxide. For reasons nobody quite understands, by the 1950s, a century of scientific research disappeared. Those with skin disorders turned to pills and creams. Those with asthma managed symptoms with steroids and bronchodilators. Patients with severe mental disorders were given sedatives. The drugs never cured schizophrenia or other psychoses, but they didn't provoke out-of-body experiences or feelings of euphoria either. They numbed patients and continued to numb them for weeks, months, and years, as long as they kept taking them. "What's interesting to me is that nobody disproved it," says Feinstein of carbon dioxide therapies. "The data, the science, still holds today." He tells me how he'd stumbled upon some obscure studies by Joseph Wolpe, a renowned psychiatrist who rediscovered CO2 therapy and reported just a few huffs of the stuff provided stunning improvements for so many of his patients. Dr. Donald Klein suggested in the 1990s that the gas might help reset chemoreceptors in the brain, allowing patients to breathe normally so they could think normally. Since then, few have studied carbon dioxide treatments. Feinstein kept wondering if all those early researchers were right, if this ancient gas might be a remedy to modern ailments. "As a psychologist, I think, what are my best options? What is the best treatment for these patients?" Feinstein says. "Pills offer a false promise and do little good for most people," he tells me. "Anxiety disorders and depression are the most common mental illnesses in the United States, and about half of us will suffer from one or the other in our lifetime. To help cope, 13% of us over the age of 12 will use antidepressants, most often selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, also known as SSRIs. These drugs have been lifesavers for millions, especially those with severe depression, but less than half the patients who take them get any benefits. I keep asking myself," says Feinstein, "is this the best we can do?" He'd explored various non-pharmaceutical therapies in the past. He'd spent a decade learning and teaching mindfulness meditation. A wealth of research shows that meditation can relieve anxieties and boost compassion. It can work wonders, but few of us will ever reap these rewards because the vast majority of people who try to meditate will give up and move on. For those with chronic anxieties, the percentages are far worse. Feinstein explains, "Mindful meditation, as it is typically practiced, is just no longer conducive to the new world we live in." Another option, exposure therapy, presents patients repeatedly with their fears so that they become more accepting of them. It's highly effective, but takes a while, usually involving many long sessions over weeks. Finding psychologists with that kind of time and patients with the necessary resources can be a challenge. But everybody breathes, and today, so few of us breathe well. Those with the worst anxieties consistently suffer from the worst breathing. They have low CO2 levels and a much greater fear of holding their breath. To avoid another attack, they breathe far too much and eventually become hypersensitized to CO2. They are anxious because they're overbreathing, overbreathing because they're anxious. Feinstein found some inspiring recent studies by Alicia Moret, the Southern Methodist University psychologist who helped her patients blunt asthma attacks by increasing their carbon dioxide with slow breathing. This technique worked for panic attacks, too. Moret gave 20 panic sufferers capnometers, which recorded the amount of carbon dioxide in their breath throughout the day. Moret then crunched the data and found that panic, just like asthma, is usually preceded by an increase in breathing volume and a decrease in CO2. To stop the attack before it struck, subjects breathed slower and less. The simple and free technique reversed dizziness, shortness of breath, and feelings of suffocation. It could effectively cure a panic attack before the attack came on. "Take a deep breath is not a helpful instruction," Moret wrote. "Hold your breath is much better." We leave Feinstein's office and stroll through a labyrinth of elevators and staircases till we enter through soundproof double doors. Through the door to my right, Feinstein and his team conduct research on flotation, a therapy that involves lying in a saltwater pool in a dark, soundless room. Through the door to the left is Feinstein's newest project, a carbon dioxide therapy lab. It's a tiny windowless box that looks like it might have held HVAC equipment at one time. We squeeze into it like clowns in a phone booth. On a folding desk is the usual array of monitors, computers, wires, EKGs, and other stuff I've grown accustomed to wearing over the past few years. A beat-up yellow cylinder sits in a corner. Feinstein tells me that it holds 75 pounds of pure carbon dioxide. For the past few months, as part of his NIH research, Feinstein has brought in patients suffering from anxieties and given them a few hits of this gas. So far, he tells me, the results have been promising. Sure, the gas elicited a panic attack in most patients, but this is all part of the baptism by fire process. After that initial bout of discomfort, many patients reported feeling relaxed for hours, even days afterwards. I've decided to throw my own chemoreceptors into the ring. I've signed up to see what a few heavy doses of CO2 would do to my body and brain. Feinstein sticks a piece of white foamy material with a metal sensor onto my middle and ring fingers. The device will measure small amounts of sweat released during states of sympathetic stress. On my other hand, a pulse oximeter will record my heart rate and blood oxygen levels. The mixture I'll inhale is 35% carbon dioxide and the rest room air. This is about the same percentage of CO2 once used to treat schizophrenics. Feinstein calmly explains, for the third time today, that any suffocation I might feel is only an illusion, that my oxygen levels will remain unchanged, and that I'll never be in any danger. Although he means to calm my fears, the constant disclaimers only make me, well, more anxious. "You good?" Feinstein says, tightening the Velcro straps on the face mask. I nod, take a few last sweet inhales of room air, and sink deeper into the chair. We'll begin takeoff in 2 minutes. As Feinstein walks over to a computer and futzes with tubes and wires, I'm left to sit, stare at my cuticles, and reminisce a bit. My mind wanders to last year, when I first visited Anders Olsen in Stockholm. It was just after our interview in the co-working reception hall, and Olsen took me into his office, a little hovel filled with research papers, pamphlets, and books. Olsen told me that he and a group of DIY pulmonauts had been running their own experiments with CO2 over the past couple of years. They weren't interested in the megadoses used to treat epilepsy or mental disorders. They weren't sick. They were interested in exploring the preventative and performance benefits of the gas, in flexing their chemoreceptors even wider so that they could push their bodies even further. The most effective and safest blend they found was a few huffs of around 7% CO2 mixed with room air. This was the super endurance level Buteyko found in the exhaled breath of top athletes. Breathing in this mixture didn't trigger any of the hallucinations and panic. You hardly noticed it at all, and yet it offered potent results. Olsen shared some reports from pulmonauts in the field. User number 1. So, I'm in Toronto now, and I decided to go for a rollerblade. I'm a big rollerblader and have done this route by the water on Lakeshore many times before. But get this, no matter how hard I pushed it, and I pretty much gave it 110% the entire time, I not once needed to open my mouth to pant. User number 2. I did some carbon dioxide treatments 3 times yesterday, about 15 minutes apiece. And today I went canoeing, and then when I had sex with my girlfriend, by the end of it she was panting and tired, and I wasn't even out of breath at all. I felt like I was superhuman. User number 3. Holy fuck. I was breathing, and I started to feel frickin' amazing, euphoric even, to the point where breathing felt automatic. Olson hooked up a CO2 tank and offered me a few huffs. I felt a slight spaciness, which was soon followed by a slight headache. I was unimpressed. Back in Tulsa, Feinstein is about to administer something else entirely. It's several times what I had before, and several thousand times more than my chemoreceptors are normally exposed to. He reaches over and points to the big red button on the desk. It switches the air hose from room air to the carbon dioxide in a foil bag hanging on the wall. The bag is a precautionary device. I'll be huffing from it instead of directly out of the tank in case there's a malfunction in the system or my brain. Should a faucet stay open or should I suddenly start panicking, I'll only be able to breathe the contents of that bag, which works out to about 3 big lungfuls. Next to the red button is the stress dial. It will record my perceived anxiety. It's currently set to 1, the lowest number. When I start feeling anxious, I can crank the dial up as far as 20, marking an extreme state of panic. Over the next 20 minutes, I'll need to take 3 big inhales of CO2. I can take all 3 breaths one after the other if I'm feeling comfortable. If not, I can wait several minutes between hits. The amount of time patients wait provides insight into how intense the experience was. Strapped in and ready, I'm trying to calm myself, watching the live feed of my vitals on the computer monitor. It starts to feel like I'm a fighter pilot on a stealth mission, hissing these Darth Vader breaths through a face mask, my hand on a red button. Not the kind of scene I'd ever associated with mental health therapy. But Feinstein's goal isn't to change the way a patient feels on an emotional level. It's to reset the basic mechanics of the primitive brain. Chemoreceptors, after all, don't care if the CO2 in our bodies comes from being strangled or drowned or panic or a foil bag in Tulsa. They set off the same alarm bells. Experiencing such an attack in a controlled environment helps demystify it. It teaches patients what panic feels like before it comes on, so we can prevent it. It gives us conscious power over what for so long has been considered an unconscious ailment, and it shows us that many of the symptoms we're suffering can be caused and controlled by breathing. One more slow and deep inhale, a thumbs up, and I close my eyes. I push all the air out of my lungs and punch the red button. I hear the hose engaged to the foil bag. Then I take in an enormous breath. The air tastes metallic. It oozes into my mouth, zinging my tongue and gums. I feel it push deeper down my throat, coating my innards. It cracks through my alveoli and into my bloodstream. I brace myself for the hit. 1 second. 2 seconds. 3. Nothing. I feel no different than I did a few seconds ago or a few minutes before that. I hold the stress dial at 1. Feinstein said this might happen. He'd given this heavy dose to a Wim Hof practitioner months earlier, and the man barely felt anything. After so much heavy breathing and breath holding, Feinstein hypothesized that the subject had already flexed his chemoreceptors wide open. Meanwhile, I'd just come off of 10 days of forced mouth breathing followed by 10 days of forced nasal breathing. I'd raise my resting CO2 levels by around 20%. I too have probably flexed my chemoreceptors as far as they could reasonably go. Amid these thoughts, there's a slight constriction in my throat. It's subtle. I take in a breath of air, push it back out. This requires some effort. The red button is switched off. I'm no longer breathing any more of that CO2, but it feels like someone has jammed a sock in my mouth. I try to take another breath, but the sock keeps growing. Okay, now there's a pounding in my temples. I open my eyes to check my levels, but the room is all blurry. A few seconds later, it's like I'm looking at everything through cracked binoculars. I can't breathe. Every sense feels as if it's being vacuumed out of me. It's terrible. Maybe 10 or 20 seconds pass before the sock shrinks, there's a cooling at the back of my neck, and the whirlpool of anxiety reverses and floats off. The color and clarity of my vision ripples outward, like a hand clearing mist from a window. Feinstein stands a few feet from me, staring. It all comes back to life. I can breathe again. I sit there for a few minutes, sweating, kind of laughing, kind of crying. I'm trying to prepare myself for two more inhales of this ghastly mixture of gas. Any self-talk I can muster, this choking is only an illusion. Relax, it will only take a few minutes. None of this does anything. After all, the fear I've just felt and would feel again with the next hit won't be mental. It's mechanical. Conditioning the chemoreceptors to widen takes a few sessions, which is why Feinstein's patients come back to re-up over the course of a few days. This is, at its core, an exposure therapy. The more I expose myself to CO2, the more resilient I'll become. And so, in the name of research, and for the sake of my future mental health, I push the red button and take two more hits, one after the other. And I panic again and again.